So you still should tell me really what the real scope is.
Yes, I will. I want you to talk about your research. That's what it's about. The development of your ideas. Mm-hmm. Why you went from where you were when you were writing about, what is soledad? I do know no Spanish.
Soledad is solitude.
Solitude, but the solitude in 19th century and 19th and 20th century poetry, that was your first. Mm-hmm. You may start at the beginning now and go backwards if that's better, or it would be interesting to have you talk about a particular work that is central to your idea. Introduction on here. Mm-hmm. This is an interview with Birute Cipliauskaite. Would you like to pronounce it?
Cipliauskaite.
For the Oral History Project, the date is December 3rd, 1984. My name is Laura Smale. This is an opportunity for you to talk about your research and how your ideas have developed. Maybe I'll let you begin where you'd like to begin.
Mm-hmm. Well, you would like...
Wait. Mm-hmm.
You'll let me know.
Yes.
Since it is to be about research, I think it's best to start from the beginning, which was, of course, my first book is my dissertation. Mm-hmm. So it's very simple. Now, the dissertation may have interest in that way that if I went to graduate school to obtain a PhD, it was mainly because I wanted to write my dissertation. When I arrived at graduate school, I didn't know what it was about, but I knew what I wanted to write about. So I actually go the other way from the others.
Yes.
Because usually people come with the mind that they want a degree, they want to teach. That was not at all my preoccupation. I knew that I wanted to work on that subject.
Well, then you'll have to say why.
Why?
You do that.
Because there is a very interesting book on solitude in Spanish poetry, starting with the early ages and going up to the 17th century, which has never been continued. And I liked that book very much. I also found that in contemporary 20th century poetry mainly, there is very much solitude, and it seemed just the right thing to do. So, of course, for that I needed then to get all my research tools, because when I went, I got my PhD at Bryn Mawr, I had never done any real studying before that. I did not have an undergraduate degree in Spanish at all. So I really acquired all my knowledge in 2 years at Bryn Mawr.
You had the language already.
What language did you have? Oh, before Spanish, I already spoke fluently, of course, my own, which is Lithuanian and German and French and English.
But of the Spanish, you spoke Spanish, and there are other languages out there in Spain.
Oh, no, but I mean, Spanish is the only real language.
All right.
I shouldn't say the real language, but after all, it is the general language, because then you have the Catalan, and you have the Gallego, and you have the Basque, but they are very much localized to the provinces. So that, no, these I don't know. I mean, I know Catalan, and I can read the Gallego, but no, that was not even included when I do research, or when I write about something, or when I teach. We teach only Spanish Castilian, written in Castilian. That is quite a separation in Spain. Mm-hmm. So that, I suppose, explains more or less the work on that dissertation. And I, again, approached it in different facets. For instance, not necessarily taking the poets who speak most of solitude, but taking a cross-section from the very beginning of the century and going back actually to the Romanticism poets in 19th century, and then touching on every important generation in 20th century. And I did include one chapter is dedicated to one poet who anybody, when they pick up the book, say, well, and how did he come there? Because that is Jorge Guillén, who simply doesn't believe in solitude. But I did take him then as an example of how one can deny solitude and how one can substitute constant company for it.
I'm trying to think of a question to you're exploring solitude, mm-hmm. how it's expressed or why it's so important.
Oh, no. With me, whatever, all right. I'm interested in literary work as artwork. Mm-hmm. And of course, you have to take into consideration the social circumstance, the historical circumstance, the philosophy very much for solitude, but that is only as background. My concern is to see what they do in order to write and make an impact on that subject, solitude. Mm-hmm. So it is really more a study of poetics in a way, which then was to be my second book, and not of theme so much, although solitude seems very much a theme.
Yes, it does.
It is, and it is, I agree, that it is a thematic study. But while I was working on it, I just became aware of how differently each poet goes at it, and in order to express it. Mm-hmm. And that led me then to the second book, which is probably the book I'm best known for, which is the idea of poetry, the poetics of the 20th century.
I see.
Mm-hmm. So you want me to go on now to the second book, or do you still want me to do to elaborate more?
It's up to you. Mm-hmm. What you discovered and when you did, and mm-hmm. whether it's in the course of writing or if it was all laid out in your head before you even.
Oh, it started. Is. I usually have it in my head before I start writing. I would say the actual process of writing takes very little time for me.
Hmm.
It is the research that takes all the time, the reading.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, while you are reading, you are getting ideas, and these ideas start organizing themselves in certain clusters. And so what I do, of course, is having index cards, all kinds of index cards, but at the same time then also having simply little bits of paper anytime an idea comes to me, mm-hmm. how they could be connected, so that by the time I decide that I have really now read enough, that I have the material, it's simply the matter of sitting down and laying out all my cards and trying to synthesize. So that the writing is relatively simple, and I would say it doesn't give me that much pleasure.
Oh.
No, the reading is much more pleasure, except that, of course, if I don't write, then it all remains in my head.
That's interesting. So people often talk about it, uh-huh. a joy that is felt once the writing is done.
No, it's not joy. Once I have written, it's dead.
Hmm.
So it's, in a way, a parting. I wouldn't consider it a joyful feeling, also, usually. Whatever I do with such intensity that practically every book has left me in bed, sick.
Oh, really?
So that joy, no. No.
Not even when, just immediately,
mm-hmm.
when the ideas are down and expressed.
No, because also I'm never quite satisfied with what I do. I mean, there you have written, you realize that you are not going to proceed beyond it. And it is not really what you hoped to do.
Was this true of the book on 19th and 20th century poetry also?
Oh, yes, because that is, of course, a much more vast subject.
Oh.
So that you know that you simply have to cut off at a certain point. It was meant also, since there was nothing of the kind for Spanish literature, it was meant mainly as just a cluster of ideas from which others could start,
mm-hmm.
and work proceeding more specifically, you know, or on a smaller area maybe, but then going really and exploiting it totally, which I couldn't do.
So you were setting out, in effect, a map of 19th and 20th century poetry?
Yes, not poetry, but what the poets thought about poetry, what the poetry meant for them, what they were doing when they were writing poetry.
You found this out through their poems or through other writings?
Through their poems and through the critical writings. And then, of course, you have to take into consideration the criticism that has been written on these poets also. Now, what always one realizes is that what they write about theoretically very seldom corresponds to what they do then as poets. So again, to solve these conflicts takes a little bit of thinking. Most helpful documents in these cases are letters among them, because there they don't write for the publicity. They really write when they are preoccupied with something, and there's a real exchange of ideas. But there aren't letters, published letters, for every one of them. So again, I mean, it is always an area which I feel just like an adventurer going to America 5 centuries ago. You know, I suppose that is saying too much, but you wouldn't, at least I wouldn't, approach a subject which has been really worked on very much. If I have, whatever I have done, I thought I was doing it because there was not enough on that.
There had been histories of 19th and 20th century.
Yes, but that's something very different.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And you did this as still a comparatively beginning scholar, is that not right?
Oh, yes, oh, yes. I remember that very well. I mean, my second book was, I started working on it actually right away, the first year after I had finished my dissertation. And I was introduced in Spain. I did write both my books in Spain. I mean, I did all the research in Spain. And I was introduced while I was starting to work on that second book to a very famous scholar. And he looked at me and he said, "You know, your project is very interesting. The only thing I would like to say, that that's a project that somebody undertakes when he is 65 years old or more."
Mm-hmm.
Well, I still
what did
am...
You say?
I said that's just an idea I have, and I'll try. And I'm glad that I did it, because today I wouldn't do it. I have become much more skeptical, and I see much more today than I did 15 years ago, 20 years ago, what I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you need to be a little bit naive.
But that your naivete didn't hurt the work, evidently.
No, because as I say, that is the work that really has given me the name. So it was necessary. It was simply necessary. And I didn't pretend to write a Bible. I simply pretended to put together some ideas which would make others think and which would make others engage into further research. That was the only thing. And I think it fulfilled what it proposed. And today I look at it, I think, yes, it's naive. But it still has, I mean, the great merit of the book, I think, is that at that time, when I worked, most of these little texts, like when I say letters or little articles, sometimes unsigned in the periodicals, were inaccessible. There just was nothing. I had to go to private houses, private archives, to some state archives where you couldn't get in, because many of these poets were Republican, and under Franco you couldn't get at them. So for every little bit of newspaper, I had to get a special permit from the military government. I mean, it was just incredible. So I think that was my merit, the patience and the accumulation of texts which many people had never seen. Today, it's so much easier to work, because so much has been published, and that is why today my book looks very naive.
Is that one of the reasons that nothing had been done, is that everything had been so closed? Let's see, this is in the 1960s,
well, that was early 60s that I worked on it, yes. Well, you must take into consideration a few points, I think. One is that poetry is something that attracts usually less attention, and fewer people are working on poetry. It was also a very ambitious project, because to go through various generations, all the poets, not trying to explain a few poems, but to trying to get to the marrow of the bone, so to say, of what poetry means for them, isn't easy. Again, I had to get a philosophical background, I had to read a lot of theory. In those days, even that was lacking. So it was very much an explorer's work. And I don't know whether it was that. It's that often people work on one poet or one book, which is easier, or watch movement. Mm-hmm. And then you can do it much better, I think. But it is this synthetic view that was lacking very much.
Did you have any trouble deciding which poets to include?
No, again, I was totally arbitrary. I had read, after all, I had written my dissertation. Actually, this book came out of my first book, because when you work on, at least when I work on a subject, I gather so much material that I can't possibly put it into one book. And then the idea comes from, I've actually always worked in pairs. I've always produced books in pairs. And then the second book is already with the leftover material to which you add something more, you develop a new facet, and then I feel now I've really had enough of that.
I see. And I was wondering why each book didn't build out of the preceding.
No, I have sometimes asked myself whether I do things in the right way, because as you know, there are scholars who work on one author or one movement, and then of course they become the world authority on that one author, and there is not one page that or one line of that author that they didn't know. I found it dangerous, because after the second book, whenever I heard a lecture on poetry, I always told myself, but there's nothing new, I know all that, and that's not a good attitude. So I went to work on something I didn't know at all.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily think you'd have to concentrate on one person, but I would think that maybe, for instance, you said you had presented a number of ideas about 19th and 20th century poetry in your second book, that you would then have pursued one of those with interest or
well, no, at that point I felt that I simply had read all that there was to read, and I knew all that there was to know about these poets. And it simply wasn't a challenge anymore.
Well, would it be boring to you?
It
perhaps?
Would have been boring. So I wanted something totally different.
Before we go there, what gave you your understanding of, or gives you your understanding of poetry?
That's, you know, everything in life is a mystery. I never liked poetry. I never read poetry. I only started reading poetry when I went one summer to Spain without speaking Spanish, went to a summer school for a month, and heard four lectures on poetry, and one lecture on two poets, and after that one lecture I said, that's my life.
On what poet?
Guillén and Salinas. And I still didn't know what poetry is, but poetry started meaning something to me, and I started reading poetry, and I still don't know whether I know what poetry is.
Didn't you say you didn't have the language yet?
No, I didn't. But in 1 month, I acquired it.
Were the lectures in English or Spanish?
No, Spanish. That gives more mystery when you only half understand. Mm. It's just the right atmosphere for poetry. So I really wouldn't be able to tell you anything more. I don't necessarily think I know that much about poetry.
But you're not a poet yourself?
No. No, if I were a poet, I wouldn't write books of criticism. I think it must be much more joyful experience to create, really. So,
did the second book have an impact in Spain?
Yes, in Spain, mainly in Spain. I publish in Spain, and I write in Spanish, as you know. And actually, there is never anybody that I would meet in Spain who works in the academic circles who wouldn't know that book. So I think it had impact.
Would they grudge you, a foreigner, writing something?
Oh, no, no, the Spanish are very generous. Why should they grudge? I think they should be, really should be and are thankful that somebody is showing interest. There is no competition. There are wide fields open for work. No, and my experience in Spain has always been extremely happy. Most generous people in the world.
Sorry, it just happens here.
Let's see, how long did it take you to do the book, the second book?
The second book, about 2.5 years.
Just doing only that?
No. When you teach, you teach.
You were teaching already.
I was teaching, but I was, in the first years when I was here, I was taking very often a semester without pay in order to be able to work on what I was doing. So I was in Spain for at least 6-7 months working just on that and then going the following summer again. And of course here you can do a lot of research in this library because you can only, you must be in Spain when you work on the early centuries, but when you work on something that's published in this century, anything that's published you have here. So I didn't have to interrupt totally and stop. And there was also the advantageous, I suppose, aspect that in the first years that I was here, I was not allowed to teach any graduate courses. So teaching undergraduates takes less time.
Yes. Well, so where did you turn after your second book?
After the second book,
yes.
I still didn't turn away from poetry.
No,
but
did.
I went back to the 17th century.
Yes.
And that was, again, because I didn't know much about him. And curiously enough, I must also say that, he's a poet whom I don't like. But he was a challenge.
Pronounce his name.
Góngora. He is considered the greatest poet of Spain. Mm-hmm. He's considered the most difficult poets of Spain. And when I started working on him, there were no good editions of his work because nobody wanted to tackle him. Now, again, I will say that I did not really choose him because he was only difficult. I did that work mainly to give pleasure to two friends who thought that it would be very nice if somebody would do it. And I said, well, all right.
Spanish friends,
Spanish scholars.
And what were you doing exactly?
Just an edition, and not
sonnets,
of all his work, just the sonnets. Just today I received a letter from the publisher that they have published in the meantime the fifth edition of it.
Really? So it's still the edition?
It is the edition because nobody else has done it. And the previous edition had been done sometime in the 30s. So. You know, now scholarship is so advanced that every year or every 5 years there is so much more material that you can. And I think also even the manuscripts are more accessible because the libraries and the archives are more open, more accessible. Again, that was really not great pleasure. I think that is what I've done with the least pleasure.
I see.
And that is what has ruined my eyesight, what has taken very much time, because I was working, I have made two editions. One is the critical edition, and one is a popular edition, so to say. So for the critical edition, because of all kinds of mishaps, came out only in 81, but I did it in 68, 69.
The first one then was published in 69. Was the popular edition.
That was the popular edition. That's the one that has been republished and republished and republished. because that is accessible. It's a small book. It has enough notes, mm-hmm. and it doesn't have all the scholarly bits which a normal person doesn't need. So, yet I did it only because I had started to work on the big edition.
Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to work on, or which did you
the big one.
Originally intend
oh, yes.
to
do? Oh, yes. I intended only to do the big edition.
I see.
But then the publisher asked me to do the small one. And after I did the small one, the publisher said that they didn't have money to publish the big one. Because
so
the small one brings in money.
Yes.
The big one costs
yeah.
money.
Who eventually published it?
The medieval seminary here.
Ah.
Mm-hmm. 11 years after I had done it.
Is this the do the sonnets belong to his early period or his
No,
late
they go
period?
Through hmm. through the whole.
I gather his style changed.
Well,
that right?
about that there is quite a polemic. I think that in a way maybe it changes a little, but one shouldn't say that there are really two totally different Gongoras, mm. because already the complex Gongora is in the beginning. But he also becomes much more masterful, of course, as he goes along. And yes, the first, I would say the main difference is that the first 5 or 10 years, he writes more within the tradition, within the Petrarchan tradition,
mm-hmm.
then he develops his very own style. And he goes more into ironic, satiric tones. Whereas at the beginning it's all beautiful and all.
Did you come to like his poetry better? You said you didn't like
it. Well, I still feel that he is what I would call a cold poet. I mean, he works so much that he produces the perfect beauty, but there is not the person, the living person behind that beauty. I identify more easily with a poet who palpitates behind the poetry.
That's interesting. I did the little bit I read mm-hmm. in the history of Spanish literature suggested that Guillén
mm-hmm.
is also a cold poet.
Yes, in a way. In a way. Now, he is not so cold, though. Guillén, I think, especially, well, Guillén I knew very well. He was
oh,
a very good friend, you see. So there I could see how he transforms his great emotions into these lines, which are, again, so perfect that nothing sentimental remains. But when I read Guillén, I still see the living man who writes them.
So that's why you did him then, Guillén?
Guillén. Well, Guillén, I have started working on him again. I don't know why. Because he was one of the two poets about whom I heard that lecture that
yes.
converted me. I was a French major, and I went over into Spanish. He is still not my preferred poet. He is the poet on whom I've written most, definitely. Because he's just so admirable. I mean, he is the greatest poet of Spain in his generation. There's just no doubt about that in my mind. And also because he is so totally opposed to me. He is totally affirmative. Everything is either perfect or perfectible. It's just mm-hmm. the joy, you see.
Mm-hmm.
It's and when you read him, it just makes you happy. And
yes.
also, it is so nice to work on a poet who is just so good. He gives you. I mean,
so
you
good. Are you talking about morally or
No. I'm talking
a
as a poet.
Yes, all right.
As a poet. No. No.
He was good also.
Well, I don't put into the work. That doesn't matter really. But you see, that is maybe true also of Góngora. The more complex, Guillén is also quite a complex poet. The more complex a poet is, the greater joy when you read one poem and in that one poem you see so much. Whereas the very simple ones, you read the poem, you say, well, that's nice, but there is nothing to write about because everybody reads it and it's plain. So that could be one of the reasons. I really couldn't tell you how I got on to Guillen, of all, because I included him. I mean, he is in every, practically in every book of mine. I gave him a chapter in Soledad. He was the poet who doesn't believe it's in solitude, you see.
Mm-hmm, yes.
He's so affirmative. Then, of course, he has his great part in the second book on poetics. And then I have a whole book on him. And I have very many articles on him. So he's just fascinating. I think you just cannot help. You must admire him. You don't need to identify with him. You just have to admire him. It's just, it's all light.
When you write about somebody like that, do you bring in poets from other nationalities and of earlier times?
Well, whenever I see that there is any connection to be made, I try to. I don't like to isolate a figure about which I am writing. That is really my greatest, I don't know whether to call it vice or drawback or mistake, because it takes me much longer but I just think that you have to read it context. I mean, it's fine to read without context, but it means more if you read it in context. And then how could I dare to say that Guillen is the greatest poet, not in Spain even, but in those years in all of Europe, if I didn't know and couldn't compare.
So you're
reading all the
French,
mm-hmm,
and English.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I think that's the way I was taught to approach literature. You see, I have the advantage of coming from a country which has a very small literature. So we always read in context. And I like it. I don't know what else I should I say. Anything else about Góngora? About Góngora, I should probably say about the process of working, because that, you see, that again, I don't regret having done it, but I would never repeat it, because I consider those years really almost lost years in my life, because you go to the library and you go through manuscripts. I have read, there is no autograph of Góngora. So in order to establish the text, you simply have to read all the manuscripts that exist. Well, I've read about 200 manuscripts, line by line, and that's a very technical work which needs very much attention and which gives very little satisfaction. You know, then when you start noticing, for instance, that two lines are totally different and start thinking why, well, then becomes interesting. Or when you decide to go and hunt for any clue as to who that person was, and you discover that it was somebody totally different from what the other critics said. Again, that gives you great satisfaction. It's almost discovering a new island. But this doesn't happen often. The rest is just plowing through something very technical, and I'm very untechnically minded. So that it is, it did serve me mainly to teach me not to be critical about other people's work. Because it's so easy to say, well, but that's not complete, or there is a mistake. But then you realize how easy it is to make those mistakes, and that you sometimes can't see everything, really. I've traveled all across Europe hunting for those manuscripts. But as I say, it was a more work of patience than of any creativity. And Góngora is, for instance, somebody I don't like to teach. After having done all this work, I've been mainly in Europe, in any country, people ask me always, well, would you come and give lectures about Góngora? And I say, no. I really, I really have had, once I finished. He's also outside of the centuries in which I always work. So I feel I did what I could and let others do now the rest. But I don't regret having done it. I don't think I have much more to say about Gongora, really. I'm not very good in counting anecdotes. You know, when you work, all kinds of things happen, but there wasn't anything very memorable that would have occurred. And he still, not all his work has been edited. I mean, he has been published, but not this line-by-line, word-by-word, comma-by-comma edition. But there is quite a lot of progress lately. Spain has waited for a long time until somebody started doing really, I shouldn't call it scholarly work, but maybe careful work. Spanish scholars tended to be a bit superficial. And if you are just even a bit superficial, you can't work on that. Because accuracy is really the only thing that counts. And I suppose one could probably even do it, no, but you can't collate manuscripts by computer. You still can't. It might become easier later on, but no, I've done it all just on my own. So that's for Gongora. And from there, what did I do from there? Oh yes, and then I went into prose. I have felt, actually not that I had done enough poetry, but most of the ideas then from then on have arisen when I have taught. And when you teach, I remember when I was for the first time teaching a survey course on 20th century novel, and there were books of criticism on one author, on another author, and then I realized that on Pio Baroja there just wasn't a book which I could take and learn much from it and tell students, well then, go and read it. It's not that I would write a book thinking that now I can tell the students, go and read it, but at least to give myself an idea of who he really was. And again, he is an author whom I don't like very much. There are very few authors whom I really like very much about whom I have written. I don't know, I think in a way it is probably better, because that way you don't identify too much. I think a critic must keep a distance, and it's not difficult for me to keep a distance with Gongora or Baroja. You simply take it as a task more. And that was interesting. That was interesting to work, because again I had to start learning from the beginning. In all my graduate work, I had never had a course, I think, on the novel. I've had very little work anyway in graduate school. So that all my learning has been afterwards. And how I went about it, well, that was again already a book in which I started to be complicated. Because when I went out of graduate school, I was able to always tell myself, well, I'll do that and right away have a very systematic plan of how I was going to go about it. And there was just that approach and you went. Well, with Baroja, I realized that you can't do that. I wanted to write about his style because it was mainly about his style, that nothing had been written. But then I realized that he is so much in what he writes that you can't talk about the style unless you talk about the man. And that wasn't easy to resolve, because as you know today, critics look down on those who take the author also into account. But I had to do it, so I made in a way an analysis. I must confess I don't even remember what I did in that book much anymore. But I did make an analysis first of his approach to literature, of his formation as a writer, and only then go into real analysis of his work. And now that analysis again did give me some joys, especially because, as you know, probably that was the beginning of the century yet, or even in the 20s, many authors used to publish their novels in periodicals. I don't remember how you call it in English. You know, when
serials.
In serials. That's it. So that I went back again. I spent much time in the libraries, and just before I was going home, now that was the whole book was a very curious thing. I had my idea about what the book was to be, and I had it practically all lined out, and then I got a grant for the summer, and thought I will go and check, because in Baroja's house, I had read in one author's book, there were four manuscripts. And I thought, well, I don't want to write about him without checking those manuscripts. Well, I went and I discovered that there were 23 manuscripts, not four manuscripts. So that summer, I was very lucky. I could rent the most beautiful house in that little village. I never saw that little house. I used to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and work until 12 o'clock at night. And I barely went through old materials. But that was a fascinating thing, because Baroja had the fame, the reputation, that he wrote as it came to him, that he never worked on. Well, of some novels, of one novel particularly, I found four different copies, you know, drafts, versions. Well, you can't say after that the man didn't work. And then as I was going already back to Madison, I had 3 days in Madrid, and I thought, well, I just better go and check whether I still can find some of these periodicals of the serials. And there I discovered that one of his novels in the serials appeared in a totally different way. That midway in the novel, then, as he publishes as a novel, he adds one of the major characters. And nobody had seen it until that. That's just incredible, because he is a much-read author. People had written about him, but nobody had taken the trouble. So there are these joys of discovery. But that, of course, then changed totally what I was going to write. My book, which I thought was more or less ready in my mind, turned out to be something totally different. And that was very interesting. Now, again, Baroja has written very much. So while I was writing that book about his style as a novelist, I realized that I cannot possibly do him justice if I try to cover all the aspects, because he has also written, apart from the contemporary novels, historical novels. So I decided to leave the historical novels for some later time. And out of that came another book. Because then I took not only him, but I took the other members of his generation, who all were interested in historical novel, and went back and studied another author, Galdós, of the 19th century. But you realize how I then get into these projects, which can't be done very quickly, because his historical novels are 22. Galdós' historical novels are 46. And the others also have written. And for that wasn't really that much. But for that, I had to really work on the theory of historical novel, because up to this date, there has been very little written on the historical novel. So I have
even generally, you mean not just in Spain?
No, not only in Spain. No, also generally. I had then to go into the philosophy of history. I had to go into history of historiography, and I read many historians and saw how their style was changing. I mean, it always branches out very much. But again, after I did that, although I still could have probably leftovers, I decided that was about as far as I wanted to go.
Were you able to incorporate what you learned from reading the histories and the
Oh yes, yes, yes. Oh yes. Oh, definitely, definitely. That because one goes
very
with the
big
other.
Major work to them.
Well, no, no. My books are getting slimmer and slimmer. I think I'll reach soon a point where I won't write anymore. Because you can say what you want in few words and few pages, but you have to really incorporate it, because if you don't, then I think it would be unjust to speak about the historical novel without referring to history, because the writing of history has changed so much, the philosophy of history has changed so much, and that all reflects in the novel, in the historical novel writing. Consciously or unconsciously, I really could never say that all the authors who write historical novel have read so much, but many of them have. There again, I had to go and look into their diaries, into whatever they have written, not as fiction, but on literature. And that is, again, a very interesting part. That I always like to read more than to write, as I say, because once you have to put it all together, if you make a mistake, well, that's bad. Whereas while you're reading, you don't make mistakes.
You say it was not a big book, but the ideas in it could have been, if you had,
mm-hmm.
were the first person to really, or one of the first to really look at what historical fiction is,
well,
could be. Do you feel that you made some?
I don't know. You know, it takes time, and this I published with a publisher who doesn't distribute his books very well. And somehow this, I think, is probably the book of mine which has had least impact.
And might have had most, is that what you're
saying? No, I don't think it might have had most, but I think it might have more.
Mm-hmm.
But just recently I'm starting to receive letters from persons saying, oh, I've read that book of yours. Oh, isn't that something?
Mm-hmm.
But this is now 3 years after it came out.
Who was the publisher?
Porrúa Turanzas.
Oh, Spanish
publisher. Oh, yes, oh, yes. I always publish in Spain. Mm-hmm. So that I really wouldn't dare to say that it has had any impact. Mm. It has helped me for teaching. It has helped me also to direct a dissertation, which has been published also. So I think that way it was productive.
Did it occur to you to write something in English, or have you written something in English based on that, about the historical novel?
Oh, no, no, I don't like writing in English. I have written, I don't know, altogether maybe 10 articles in English, not more than that. Spanish comes much more
writing
easily.
Writing in Spanish and having somebody translate it?
That I would be very difficult, because I think that it's so difficult to translate exactly. And yet, I write more easily in Spanish. So, no, I didn't think of it.
And the subject's of interest now because of
mm-hmm.
Peter Gay's lectures.
Who was
talking about
yes.
the historical. No, he wasn't specifically.
No, he wasn't talking
he had,
really.
He had
mm-hmm.
talked about it. I mean, that is
mm-hmm.
one of his fields.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is a subject of,
mm-hmm.
And I don't recall having read anything about the theory.
No, there is one very good book on the theory of historical novel, and that's Lukács. Of course, you have the very Marxist approach, from which you have to weed out some things which to me seem unacceptable. But basically, he has said things that nobody else has said. So I still always recommend that as a first to the students, and I think you can learn from it very much. But he writes mainly about the 19th century novel, whereas I have written mainly on 20th century authors. And there, the outlook on history, for instance, these authors whom I have studied, write historical novels, but they don't, in a way, believe in official history. So they are creating a totally new concept. Unamuno calls it intra-history, which is not history of battles or of dates or of kings, but of the common people and their everyday lives. And they only talk about cyclical time then. So all that is very new. That, of course, you wouldn't find in Lukács.
That's right. There's the Italian who's done the book on the miller in the...
Manzoni.
No.
No.
Ginsburg.
Oh, I see. Ginsburg, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but
position.
Ginsburg, I went to listen to his lecture. He knows very little about theory of historical novel. He shouldn't talk.
Oh.
He was misquoting. He was attributing ideas of one to somebody else. I was very disappointed in that lecture. I mean, he probably knows enough as historian, but he certainly doesn't know what has been written, and he hasn't even referred to. In France, there have been a few articles or parts of a book in the structuralist critics mainly, who have approached it in an interesting way. I mean, you must take that in account. You can't just say that there, nothing has been written. So Ginsburg disappointed me.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Mainly, I mean, he was quoting ideas of saying that they were of Momigliano, and these ideas are in Nietzsche already. So that's really going far.
And you're not tempted then, hearing this inadequate
uh-huh.
lecture, to yourself write uh-huh. something up? I should think you would be.
No. I mean, I've written. I've said what I wanted to say about the historical novel.
In an out of the way place.
Yes, but that just happened to be so. I wouldn't redo it. No.
So your reason for writing isn't to...
It's not to become
not
famous.
Not to educate the world.
No, because I would say that really most of my, as I've mentioned, most ideas come up when I find that I am not adequately prepared for teaching. Mm-hmm. And then I try to find out more. And then I try to formulate it, but not necessarily thinking that I'll be read. I mean, it helps me to become a better teacher. That is,
not
I
something
think.
You have to say then.
No.
Presumably,
mm-hmm.
you could become a better teacher if you just did the research and didn't do the writing.
I suppose so, except that it's much easier if you have it neatly published when you need to teach than to go through piles and piles and piles of notes.
Hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
that makes it easier.
That's an unusual reason for writing, or it strikes me as that, and maybe it isn't.
I don't know.
It may not be.
I don't know. To me, it is that until you write down, you don't formulate as well. So I think that I do help my students by trying to make it clearer. And I still consider that as long as I'm a teacher here, that's my first duty. Because again, as I say, if it were just the joy of writing, I wish I had been born with more talent and write novels or poetry or whatever. Because then I think, yes, you want to be read really.
But the given around here is that research and writing interfere with teaching. It's an absolutely assumed thing about scholarship. And here you say,
well, in my case, it's just the contrary.
In
my case, teaching interferes with writing. But since I consider that my first duty is to the student, I neglect research.
Hmm.
And
well, you just said you do the research
yes,
in order to teach better.
I do the research when I realize that there is something lacking. But if you want to see that it's not really paradoxical, by the time then I have done the research that I thought I need to, I never get to teach that course again.
Oh.
So it's paradoxical.
Mm.
That is why my writing is motivated comes out of teaching, really. I suppose in another way it goes back, even if it is in a different course totally, or on a different level.
But then it sounds to me as if you're saying that you want to understand it.
Yes,
you
of course.
You try to present something and you can't.
Of course,
only in
of
order
course.
For yourself,
very much,
then.
Very much. Because how can I present something clearly if it is not clear in my mind? And for that I need to go more deeply into it.
But I mean, it could be just for yourself, not for teaching. That is, here's a question and I can't answer it without doing the research and writing something.
Well, but you see, it has the practical basis that this I want to clarify so that I can present. Because a question about historical novel, for instance, I don't know whether it will just arise for myself only.